Hi, I'm Dave. So, and I'm a shape dynamicist. I feel like I should be confessing. I'm going to talk about some work that's been going on for roughly 2 years now between myself, Flavio, and Tim. A lot of the underlying work here was done by Enrique and Sean, and of course we have all got to thank Julian immensely for putting all this together and getting us in contact and providing vast amounts of both support in terms of moral support and also the occasional boot to actually get this thing finished and published. The fact that I'm actually currently looking at a draft which I think is entitled something like Final Correct Proof Version 10 tells you, how many iterations we've been through with this. This is a problem that has fought us quite strongly as we've gone up against it, but nonetheless, it's one which I think we really have got a good handle on and understand now, and really can make these statements with a bit of confidence. So, I don't have any diagrams by Flavio, so I've decided to have a diagram of Flavio here holding up ShapeSpace. One could argue that this should either be Julian or Tim or someone else, but given all the amount of work that he's done that's gone into my talk, that I live now somewhere up here and I'm completely supported by him. So, Okay, so brief introduction. What am I going to talk about? Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about the shape dynamics interpretation of a homogeneous but anisotropic cosmology. So I'm going to write these things down entirely in terms of shape. And what we're going to see is that by throwing away the idea of scale within this system, we are going to come up with a system that has a dynamical similarity, and hopefully I'll explain in detail what we mean by that. What we'll see, again, is that the full dynamics is general relativity where solutions to GR exist. So that is, whenever you have a solution to GR, I can translate it directly into shape dynamics, and the predictions of both will be exactly the same. However, there will be points where general relativity goes wrong, particularly at the Big Bang. Here, what I will say is that the shape equations of motion will form an autonomous system. That is, we'll be able to describe motion entirely just in terms of shape. We'll make no reference back to scale. When we can do so, we will find that this will give a continuation of our solution through the Big Bang. And notice what I'm going to say here is through. The word through is chosen quite deliberately because we don't do what normally seems to happen in quantum gravity where you have something like a bounce where you avoid the singular region. We will actually continue our equations through the point at which GR becomes singular. This continuation will be unique. There will be exactly one way of hooking up a solution on the other side of the Big Bang. It will be deterministic. I won't actually really need to invoke any new physics in order to get this. And it will be entirely classical. There is no H-bar hidden up my sleeves. Okay? So this is very, very different, I think, to sort of most approaches to singularities and what we think goes on there. And this is part of really what I consider my overarching goal, and I think one that several people here share, which is that I want to find a fully intrinsic relational description of physics. That is, a description of physics that only depends on things that are available to an observer from within the system. There is no external observer who's making observations. Yeah,
Jim. So Jim's. Call that physics. I mean, so the idea is that even though everybody gets crushed, Big Bang, still the physics is going through.
This physics will continue, yeah. You will find that...
It matters physically, right? I mean, in that sense of...
If you fall into the Big Bang, you will be utterly squashed horribly and you will not be able to continue through, but I will be able to calculate what will happen to every point in your body and on the other side. Or, yeah, I can calculate what's going to happen, I just won't be there to see it. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to begin with something that everyone's somewhat familiar with. I'm just going to write down the Friedmann equation here. This is written in terms of cosmological constants, some energy densities distributed across curvature, dust, radiation, dark matter, dark energy, whatever sort of types of fields you want to have in here. And this is really to start understanding what I mean by dynamical similarity. So the system is invariant under a rescaling of the scale factor. You keep the cosmological constant, it's well named in that way. You rescale the energy densities in curvature, dust, radiation, and dark energy or whatever this extra fluids are, and you find that under this rescaling, the dynamics is invariant. That is, there is a map between solutions which are intrinsically indistinguishable. Okay? So in this sense, I mean, you can say that there is no difference between a solution described by the set of variables on the left and set of coupling constants on the left, or distributions of energy, and those on the right. Typically, we write this alpha down as some scale factor at some time zero. This really is something that we all know since we sort of did intro cosmology. This is just saying that if Julian wants to call the scale factor of the universe today 1, and Tim says, no, no, it should be 73, we can translate between their maps of the universe, and they will completely agree on all physical observables. Okay, so as we motivate this, what we want to do is understand why we want to talk about shapes for gravity. And so what I'm doing is I'm going back to the elevator experiment. For those of you who are very sort of familiar with this, or sorry, not very familiar with this, the idea is that we want to know how gravity acts. So we suppose we are inside an elevator, or really sort of a dark box. And inside this dark box, there are two particles, which I'm going to write, just draw here. How do we know that the gravity is acting on these particles? Well, as they fall, we see that their geodesics converge, and we can see that they come closer to one another. Everybody's sort of happy with this as an idea. We can see. Okay, cool. However, if you take an intrinsic viewpoint on this as your physical system, you would say that, just messing around with the room. Okay, we would say that there is only one measurement of length in this system. There is the separation of these two points. They are one unit apart. And so if we observe the motion of these particles, you will find that at later times, the only distance apart you can define within your system is this separation. So they will be one unit apart later. And thus you cannot see the action of gravity simply acting on two particles. The effect of gravity isn't actually to change the size of the system. If I want to see the action of gravity, what I would have to do is start with three particles in some sort of triangular formation. And then as these guys evolved, what you'd find is that the angles in the triangle would actually start to close up or open up in some way or other. So in other words, gravity acts to change the shapes of objects. It doesn't act to change their scales. Okay? So this is sort of a reinterpretation of the standard elevator argument. And the general principle that we're using here is that only intrinsic observations exist. And so, yeah, this is what leads us on towards dynamical similarity. Does that do it? It's doing something weird, okay. Hey, there we go. So let me take just a second to talk about this intrinsic picture. And the question I really want to ask, the reinterpretation of physics I want to make here, is to say, what do the terms in, for example, a Lagrangian actually represent? So if you write down Lagrangian L of Q and Q dot, what are these Q and Q dot? What do they actually mean physically? We know what the mathematical symbols are, but what is the physical interpretation of them? Now, the normal thing that we say is these are positions and velocities, and we're all quite happy with that. But when immediately someone says positions and velocity, you should be asking, measured by what? Okay, if I want to tell you this is a position, how am I measuring this position? If I want to tell you this is some sort of separation, if I want to say it's the length of an object, with what am I measuring that? The standard version that we all learn when, you know, we start doing Lagrangian mechanics, that this is assumed to be measured by some lab equipment. So I have some frame, I have some laboratory rod and clock, I have a clock in the side of the room, and I measure velocities as with respect to the evolution of that clock. I measure positions with a meter stick, which conveniently I don't seem to have in this room, but nonetheless, I guess I could measure them with a hockey stick. Fine. I could measure all these distances using those physical objects. However, if you want to have a theory of everything, this is no longer available to you because you can't go outside your universe and pick up some lab equipment with which to measure the intrinsic degrees of freedom, with which to measure these Q and Q dot. So immediately, you cannot describe a theory of everything in this way. Therefore, you need to invent sort of a new interpretation of what these terms are. And this is what I'm calling the intrinsic interpretation. What this means is to pick a rod means I need to give some function of these positions a value, for example, 1, to give a notion of scale. Now, I want to try and convince you that's exactly what we normally do in physics, because when I talk about what is the length of 1 meter, it is defined as the distance between the top and the bottom of the meter stick in Paris. Okay? So if I have a Lagrangian of my universe, whatever it may look like, those will be a Q1 and a Q2, and 1 meter is defined as Q1 minus Q2. Okay? This immediately tells you that the Qs and Q dots actually would over-describe reality. The reason for that is that I can say I want my meter stick to describe my fundamental unit, and Julian could say, come on, this European nonsense, we've had Brexit. I want to define things in terms of a foot. As such, he could describe my meter stick as being 3 and a bit feet long. So any value onto which we'd projected this function would have actually given an equivalent physical description. Therefore, our physical reality has this similarity under the choice of the length of this rod. And again, this is basically you're modding out your coordinates, r to the, well, 3n or whatever, if you have a bunch of particles, by an r plus, which is the choice of your length of the rod with which you are measuring all your system. This has a really, really cool effect. And the effect of this is generally it tends to make your configuration spaces finite and compact. So for example, you could just, if you have a particle system like Julian was describing on the first day, you could take the separation of the two most separated points and describe that to be a rod. And therefore, all your measurements will be values lying on 0, 1. Okay? You no longer have to deal with infinities in quite the same way, and this makes your typically tends to make your configuration space compact if you mod out in the right way.
So yeah. you're not thinking of field theory here at all. You're just thinking of n-particle systems.
At the moment, I'm going to think of particle systems, but you could think about this in terms of field theory. You're just going to have to think a bit harder than I do.
At the moment.
Well, thank you, Julian. Yeah.
You're thinking about what you just modeled.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I am. Yeah. So this is Dave's standard disclaimer. I'm going to be doing cosmology. The reason I do cosmology instead of gravity in general is because I'm not smart enough to do field theory. You know, cosmology is to full gravity as quantum mechanics is to quantum field theory, right? And a lot of people can solve the Schrodinger equation, not so many people can solve the Yang-Mills equations. Okay? So I'm going to stick to this sort of simple particle-like interpretation of dynamics because it makes my life a lot easier, and it's sufficient to describe the system pretty well in these circumstances that I'll go into. Anything else while we're... Nope. Okay, cool. So, as I've said, I want to define all my quantities intrinsically. What this means is that then I'm going to infer my couplings observationally. So if I have a Lagrangian, and my Lagrangian has some potential, some V is equal to alpha over R1 minus R2. Yeah, I can. Something like this. I have to infer what this alpha is from observations. And again, I will argue that this is exactly how we've done physics. We did not wake up one morning and find tablets of stone handed down by God to Moses or whatever on which was written G Newton equals da 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 da, H bar equals. We had to infer these values by doing physical experiments. And we had to give them meaning by observations of these Qs and Q dots, by making relational, in fact, observations of these Qs and Q dots. And from those, we found out what these couplings were. So as an example, here I have central motion, just the Lagrangian with some sort of potential. And what we see is that if I solve the equations of motion, I've conveniently written down a Lagrangian simple enough even I can solve it. In fact, I went back and looked at my undergraduate notes to make sure I kind of got this right. But nonetheless, I can solve this system, and I can find the evolution of the radial displacement of two particles, let's say this is an Earth-Sun system or something like that, in terms of the angular displacement, or the evolution through an angle. So as the Earth orbits the Sun, it traces out a shape. under a rescaling, so that is, under, for example, Julian saying, no, no, use this foot stick instead of a meter stick. I'm sorry, Julian, I know you're against Brexit, but you're my token other English person here. Shut up, Sean. under this transformation, what I would see is that if we had measured things differently, if we had chosen a different definition of what was a meter, the shape traced out by the orbit of the Earth around the Sun would be exactly the same. Likewise, if I doubled the separation of the Earth from the Sun, there would be a transformation of the angular momentum, Newton's constants, etc., which keeps this exactly the same under this transformation. So the shape that I would see, R of Q, would be indistinguishable in these circumstances. Okay. So, yeah, and as I said, we use observations to set these coordinates, set these coupling constants.
David, can I just emphasize, this for me was the thing with Tim and Flavia and I had been hanging up. We thought we had to, we could only do our tricks with the homogeneous potential, but this just goes through for, it doesn't have to be a homogeneous potential.
Yep, well, this is something I really learned from Yuri. He gave me a good sort of, I went to Mexico City to the last shapes workshop there, watched his talk and went away going, damn it, I should have thought of this years ago. So thank you for making me both feel stupid and enlightening me. That's the job of a true teacher.
But you weren't the only one there.
No, I certainly wasn't. So let's look through a quick example of the applications of the sort of just the principle of shape dynamics in this case, the principle of dynamical similarity, to a very simple system. This is the dependency of chemistry, really, on the fine structure constant. Okay, so complete opposite end of physics from cosmology, really. But nonetheless, it sort of allows you to explore what these ideas are in a very sort of controlled environment. So we've got Coulomb-like potentials, which for now I'm going to keep homogeneous. But again, talk to Yuri, he'll tell you that we can do better. And we should always be challenged to do better, as class was telling me yesterday. So if we try and solve the Schrodinger equation, let's do this first as a 1D warm-up. What I'm going to do is take a solution to the Schrodinger equation. I'm not going to tell you what this function is, but nonetheless, I'm going to claim it solves the Schrodinger equation in one dimension. I'm going to change just my coordinates, which is just really just rescaling the entire system by doubling or tripling or whatever all the lengths that are available. Under doing this, what I find is that this new function I find by just writing g of x is some function of lambda x, so I just increase all my distances by some factor. I find that this new function g solves exactly the same equation, but with a different coupling constant and a different energy scale. Okay? So what does this mean? This means that if I changed the strength of the coupling, if I changed the fine structure constant, this wouldn't actually affect the shape of the solutions to Schrodinger's equation. It would only affect the scale. So to go through this quickly in three dimensions, what does this mean? Well, you can do this. It turns out to be a sort of absolutely trivial analogous calculation. You can do this in an afternoon if you're bored. Everyone should do it in an afternoon once while they're bored to convince themselves it's correct. When you do this, what you find is that under a rescaling of the coupling constant, you find that the eigenvalues of your solutions to Schrodinger's equation change, but not the eigenvectors. So if I have a water molecule and Klaas says, well, I want to invent a new universe where the fine structure constant has half the strength it currently does here because I'm interested in that universe for some reason. Nonetheless, his water molecule and mine will look the same, just at different sizes. And so this is a very, very powerful argument. It's a very, very sort of powerful tool for investigating scale that really isn't all that difficult to use, right? I mean, it's, again, something you can sort of plug into equations and follow your nose. But nonetheless, this comes at a price. The price that all this comes at is that you actually change the coupling constants. And what Roberto was saying yesterday is this would be defined as a different theory in this space that you were talking about, right? Whereas here, what I'm going to argue is that the shape interpretation of this is it's the same theory, it's just looked at different scales. Okay, Now notice that if I've just used a homogeneous force and I've used a single potential here, what this really tells you is that if you introduce multiple potentials or multiple forces that act on different scales, there are a class of couplings under which you will find that there is an invariance of the shapes of your system. This is just like I was talking about in the Friedman equation very early on. You have to rescale all the couplings in a complementary way, and it turns out to be pretty much just the mass dimensions that you rescale by. So, this is my personal set of aesthetics. As I've said, I want an intrinsic, I want a rods and clocks construction of cosmology, and my rods and clocks have to come from within the cosmology itself. Okay, I'm not allowed to go to my next cosmological neighbor and borrow their rod and clock. As such, what we want to do is describe shape observables in terms of other shape observables. So in other words, my final goal here is to have a theory where I write the evolution of one shape degree of freedom in terms of another. Equivalently, I'm quite happy if I can sort of parameterize both of these by some curve through shape space. That's my ultimate goal. And I want to argue that, in fact, because all notions of scale, if you put a shape hat on, are external, they are imposed by your interaction with the system, you have to put these in by hand. They should not play a physical role.
Sorry, why do you want two evolutions of shapes? I mean, the shape is already relational itself, right? You couldn't just find one evolution of one shape.
Well, I want what, but how do I know it's changed if I don't have something to measure it against?
Well, I thought the shape itself was relation.
Yes.
But there's many variables. There's many quantities describe one shape. Two quantities describe the shape of a triangle.
Yeah. So I mean, what I want is a shape variable. So I want the evolution. So if I have go back to my triangle example, I want alpha of beta. Is what I'm really saying here.
Because you don't have the triangle a second ago to compare
with the triangle now.
No, this I agree.
That's all. Yeah. This is an evolution. I want this entirely written as a curve through configuration space, configuration shape space. Okay. So as I'm going to go on and I'm sort of going to hit singularities quite hard, I want to sort of take a second to talk about what singularities are and what particularly they are not. So a singularity is really a point beyond which we cannot generally extend a geodesic. Okay, so the Hawking-Penrose theorems in a nutshell tell you that there is a point beyond which the system is geodesically incomplete. Okay, this is not what actually people always talk about when they hand wave singularities in talks like this. What people often talk about is singularities as being infinite energy density. Well, of course, infinite energy density is kind of a nonsense here because there are vacuum singularities. A Bianchi type 1 solution, a Kasner solution, is singular. There's never any matter. There's never any energy density. So it's exactly zero energy all the way through, and nonetheless, it is singular. Okay? And this is something where I sort of lay down a bit of a challenge for those of you, like Beatrice, who've worked on loops, and talk about singularities as showing up when energy densities approach the Planck density. How then do you deal with vacuum collapse? I actually don't know what the answer to that would be in these types of theories. I mean, I'm sure there must be one, but it has to be characterized by something other than just energy density blowing up. Likewise, it's not just an infinite observable. Again, just because something goes to infinity does not mean you've hit a problem with your system. Tan theta continues quite happily beyond theta is equal to pi over 2. Again, very trivial statement, but quite often you'll say, well, there's an infinity in your equations. Obviously, life has gone wrong. No, that's not necessarily true.
So what are you doing with the sort of top knot kinds of singularities?
Yeah.
Geodesic incompleteness, but nothing's blown up. It's just pushy rising.
Yeah, that's fine. That still, nonetheless, is a singularity in GR. You're geodesically incomplete. If I drop Jim along one of these geodesics, he can't tell me where he goes next. It's a question, Sean? Or you? Okay. Cool. Okay. So there are a couple of ways in which you identify singularities. Typically, these classifications were come up with by Tipler and Krolak. Basically, what you take is spatial components of your Ricci tensor, your spatial Ricci tensor, and you look at their evolution along a geodesic, and if this term blows up, you say that we're hitting a singularity. This is typically how you classify the strength of a singularity. If these guys go to infinity, you have what's called a strong singularity. That is one in which if you dropped any detector, that detector would get crushed. So you couldn't, you know, drop your little meter stick and have it flow through one of these. Okay? Nonetheless, what I want to point out here is that these aren't actually shape observables. And so you have to be very, very careful when you want to classify things on shape space in terms of this. Well, I'd have to actually contract this in some clever way with objects that would have lengths. And those objects, you're free to choose in shapes. So it's actually quite difficult.
I think that kind of addresses Jim's earlier question at the beginning of the talk, where he said, isn't scale meaningful? And you said yes, but I felt like that was a bit premature.
Oh. Scale isn't meaningful. Sorry,
I think what you wanted to say was scale is not meaningful.
In shape dynamics, we take the fundamental viewpoint that scale is not meaningful.
So the question of whether you get squashed has to do with the shape degrees of freedom.
Well, I can we'll come to this as I go through, and I will argue that if I were to evolve Sean through the Big Bang, there would not be much Sean left on the other side. But that's because I would be using you as a rod and comparing you to some other thing in space-time.
But does some part of me go to infinity?
that's a very, very... I believe that's an almost religious question. And therefore, yeah, I was going to say God can answer that one, yeah.
But there is no real infinity there in shape space.
There is no distributed
over a compact space, rather chaotically.
Yeah. Some part of you will go to zero, perhaps. But anyway, we'll talk about this. Okay. So, in order to first get a handle on this, because again, I found this a bit too hard to take on sort of head on, let's look at this in terms of a toy model. And the toy model I'm going to use to describe this is an expanding two-dimensional square well. So we've got some square well, we've got a particle which is inside the square well, and the walls are moving apart at some velocity v, and the particle is going to be just freely moving through this infinite square well. It's going to bounce off the walls. Okay? You'll see why I do this, and I think Lars has probably guessed why I'm doing this already, because it relates very strongly to the cosmological billiard scenario for Bianchi singularities, but nonetheless, you know, let's look at how this works. So we can solve the dynamics of the system very, very simply if we adopt a Newtonian approach. We just find that this particle moves at constant velocities until it interacts with a wall. When it interacts with a wall, it reflects and it loses some velocity in the direction of the wall with which it interacts. And so it loses its energy every time it bounces. Eventually, the particle is going to be moving slower than the walls are coming apart, and so eventually the walls are going to go off to infinity, the particle is going to go off to infinity a bit slower, apart from a set of measure zero that bounces off a wall and sticks, but you know, you have to really, really fine-tune things to get there. Okay, so what we want to do then is construct the intrinsic or the shape description of the system. As such, we want to say that this square well with this particle is my entire universe. It's not a particularly interesting one, but how could I describe physics if this was everything that I had access to? So if everything consists of the particle and the walls, the only rod I've got, really, is the fraction of distance between the left wall and the right wall that the particle is at. Okay? So I can call this left wall minus one, this right wall one, and I can say, give the particle an x position and a y position as a fraction of its distance between the left and the right walls. There's not a clock, so we don't actually know if the particle is slowing down. All we can see is this particle tracing out straight lines as it moves between interactions with the walls. If we change our viewpoint so that instead of saying in the Newtonian picture these walls are moving apart, but we change ourselves just to a relational viewpoint in which we say, no, this is a fixed rod, what then would we do to describe the system? Well, what we would say is that we could consider a way of sort of cartooning this, a way of getting this inside your head, is that if these walls move apart at a velocity v, imagine that I also move the system away from Jim at also the velocity v. Then the part, then the system would subtend the same angle on the cosmological sphere. And so he could convince himself, or he could lie to himself, really, that this was the evolution of the particle in the square well that was staying still. Okay? You could lie to yourself that that was happening. Then you would have a fully relational description of the system. Again, you would just be looking at it, and the Newtonian description that that Jim would come up with is that the particle moves in straight lines till it hits a wall, it bounces off the wall, and as you project this onto the celestial sphere, you're just going to see that the evolution of the system is just the particle bouncing off these stationary walls. So, why is this interesting? Well, again, we could just describe this entirely relationally. If you describe this relationally, what you'd say is that the particle just moves along geodesics. And it moves on to the geodesics apart from when it interacts with the wall, and the system is always going to be described then just by a point and a direction on the shape space. Okay? The particle is going to be here, and it's going to be moving this way. That's all we need to describe dynamics. As such, as we take t to infinity, we no longer have to say that the particle goes off forever. In fact, the particle ends up at some finite point, some finite fraction of the distance between the walls, and that distance will be given by the ratio of Vx over Vy. You can just sort of calculate that, compared to the velocity of the walls. So the particle just keeps moving in a straight line, and so what we can say then, what happens when we go past infinity? Well, again, there's nothing special about time goes to infinity, because recall, there's no clock in this system. The only thing we can say is how does this particle move as it interacts with walls or between the walls. And so if t goes to infinity, has the particle end up bouncing a few times, I don't know, it ends up here, where does the particle go after infinity? Well, the logical and only thing you can really do is just continue this line straight. And so infinity is no longer a special point of this, the evolution in shape space. If you want to consider this by projecting back into a Newtonian description, you would say that it joins up with a solution in which the arrow of time points in the opposite direction, and you can say that there is a solution which would have the particle end up getting to this point from the other direction, and you can continue past infinity just by joining these two solutions up. That's what you would come up with if you just wanted a Newtonian interpretation, but if you want an entirely intrinsic relationship, you just say the particle keeps moving in a straight line at all times apart from when it bounces off the walls. Is everybody sort of happy with this as a toy model? So yeah, this is pretty much how I described it. You can interpret this relatively two ways. The first way is quite simple. You could say, come on, Dave, I don't believe any of this shapes nonsense. That's absolutely fine. I don't say you have to. Julian might, but I don't. If you believe the Newtonian mechanics is fundamental, what we've really do is found that shape dynamics will give us a nice way of counting solutions. The number of solutions that there are to this Newtonian system is the space of asymptotic points that you can come to, and your configuration space is compact. So it's just going to be this 0,1, 0,1 cross S1 will describe all your space of solutions. Also, what you can say then is that shape dynamics is really just inventing some new principle at infinity, a bit like ekpyrosis. Yeah?
This mysterious word, ekpyrosis, I've never got around to actually working it. It's Neil Turek's
point. Yeah.
Can you explain what it means?
No.
What's the origin of it? something to do with fire burning.
Yeah, if you want me to explain ekpyrosis, that's an entire different talk. but basically the idea is that you have new principles that apply very, very near a singularity which allow you to continue solutions. Yeah. I don't quite know if you're asking for the etymology of the word, I have no idea.
Yeah. But in this case, we're not really invoking any new principles.
No, but if you project into Newtonian mechanics, you could say this is Newtonian mechanics plus a new principle.
Yeah.
What is infinity? I'm not sure I know what you mean by that.
This is time going to infinity in the Newtonian framework.
In Newtonian, okay,
because
was getting
rid of. So, let me be absolutely clear. If you are a hardcore Newtonian person, you could say no, no, Dave, time has gone to infinity. You know, what you're really doing is inventing something new beyond time goes to infinity. If you're a hardcore shape person, you go, time has no meaning here. All I can do is describe evolution on this configuration space, and hey, look, we just continue geodesics. Okay, so if you say shape dynamics is fundamental, then Newtonian mechanics works as a description of shape dynamics everywhere apart from this time goes to infinity, just because you've picked a bad time coordinate. Okay, so now that I've wasted all your time, let's get on in the last 10 minutes or so and talk about cosmological systems. So what I want to do is example the simplest cosmological systems first. And what I'm going to be doing is talking about cosmological systems that have a shape. So Friedman, Robertson, Walker doesn't actually have a shape as such. It's a bit like an equilateral triangle. You can't really see the evolution of shape in a Friedman system. So what we want to do is describe homogeneous but anisotropic cosmology. Hence, we're immediately at the Bianchi models. And Klaas is an expert on this, so ask him all your questions about these models. This is interesting for a couple of reasons. First is it's tractable, which is great. That's always my motivation for taking on a physics problem. It's one I think I can solve. The second is that we believe, to an extent, that these solutions are generic. This is modulo the Bilinski-Kolatnikov-Lifshitz conjecture, that every space-like separated point approximately becomes its own self-determining Bianchi model in the vicinity of a singularity. I'm not going to particularly defend that. If you have questions about this, please do come see me, or better, Klaas, and we can talk about this later. But the idea is that if you can solve just the Bianchi models, you can pretty much solve all of Einstein equations by arguing that point-wise, everything becomes one of these models. And as I say, these are the simplest systems with shape. Here, what I'm going to talk about is particularly Bianchi 9, because it's a compact, it's a closed universe, and it has some interesting evolution with shape. But the results we've got will pretty much generalize to any of the Bianchi classes without too much of a problem. Bianchi 8, you might have to be a bit careful with, because your potential becomes unbounded, but you know, such is life. Okay, so what is the dynamics? So I'm going to write down the dynamics of this system in terms of Misner variables. What I'm doing is I'm separating the scale, the overall volume, I'm writing volume because it's conjugate to a Hubble parameter, and the anisotropic shears. And so what you can think of is a section of this Bianchi space as being a cube, because I can't draw a three-sphere on a board, because I can't draw a three-sphere in general. And we have some length, width, and let's call this height, we'll call this width, length and width, and A relates to length over height, let's say, and B relates to width over height, something like this. And V is obviously length, width, height. Something like this, okay? So we're going to describe this just in terms of the anisotropies. Fortunately, the dynamics of a system becomes a very, very simple Lagrangian. The Lagrangian separates into an equation of motion, equations which depend on variables with scale, anisotropies. We're going to introduce a massless scalar field for reasons that it makes our equations easy to solve and actually leads to a physically distinct solution. And here we have the three Ricci scalar in terms of scale and isotropies, which acts as our potential. This is what leads to the cosmological billiards approach that Thibaut d'Amour likes and sort of really allows you to express this system in a very tractable way. The complete behavior is very, very complicated. In fact, if you don't have a scalar field in here, you get an infinite number of oscillations of all these variables as you head towards a singularity. But conveniently for us, if you introduce a massless scalar field, these turn off at some stage in a process known as quiescence. So first, let me pull out what this potential is. This potential can be separated into a scale term and a shape term, which we call the shape potential, being very imaginative. The shape potential has a form, the exact details of which aren't particularly interesting, but you can sort of see this has a threefold symmetry, and it's going to start looking a bit like these expanding walls. What you can do is if you write down this shape potential, if you draw this shape potential, it looks a bit like a, or these guys call it a Mercedes star, I think Flavio likes to call this thing, where this is in the sort of AB plane, and as you head towards the singularity, the walls of this move apart, the system becomes more and more like a triangular well, and it starts to look exactly like the toy model that I solved just a moment ago. Asymptotically, you can evolve in volume until you hit this singularity at volume is equal to zero, but we claim, as I say, that this actually has no particularly important meaning here. As we go to this singularity, the potential will end up going to zero, but our positions, our shape variables here, might look like they're going off to infinity, so we might be in a bit of trouble. However, we can perform exactly the same trick as I did in the toy model. The reason I'm doing this, of course, is just to give you a sort of cartoon of what's going on. I'll show you how this happens algebraically in terms of the full equations in just a moment. If you follow exactly the same trick, and this is just to show you that I did the trick honestly, you find that as you zoom out of this shape potentially exactly the same way, it starts to look exactly like a triangular perfect well. And so you find that this oscillating behavior is just this, looks like a ball bouncing around on this well. And how do we go through infinity? How do we go through the singularity? In exactly the same way, we're just going to continue things in linear motion.
It's only because some things have gone through, some of the shape dynamics, they've collapsed, right, into two-dimensional things.
Yeah. So what's actually going to happen as we go to our singularity is we're going to find that this cube will actually end up becoming more and more like a plane. Yeah, this is the Kasner behavior as you approach the singularity. Now, if you take scale into account, this looks like an infinite plane with zero height. If you kick scale out of this, you can claim you can set up your system so that the volume of this cube is always, for example, one, because you just define that to be your rod. And then you can evolve A of B and see how that.
The volume's still one, but it's still becoming infinite in one direction.
Yeah, it's going to become infinite in one direction, but.
It's collapsing.
So it's absolutely, it is collapsing in that sense.
Yeah, but is it not just like in the three-body problem, that's playing that zero angular momentum, it's always passing through with the linear configurations where if you say the area of the triangle is going to go to the length or something. I mean,
let me draw a picture, and hopefully this will help. So, yep. So if I look at my shape space, what I'm actually going to do is describe my shape space in these two Misner type variables. And in fact, what you're going to say is that A is something like, what is it? Tan beta sine alpha, and B is, what is it? Tan beta cos alpha, right? Flavio, correct me?
That is an absolute value around the tan.
Yep, magic. And so what we're going to see is that any one of these Bianchi 9 shapes can be described by a point on this shape space. This is where this is beta is equal to pi over 2. This is beta equals to 0, beta equal to pi. And alpha is an angle around here. Tim.
Let me just, because you of course you present everything right. It's just it may seem ad hoc that we use this parametrization. And there is a good reason for that.
Yeah.
If you use triad variables and you gauge the rotations that they are going to triad variables, then you take the unit determinant triads and parameterize them, these two angles.
Yeah.
That's where this comes from.
Yeah.
So it's not like that we invent something, we take the most natural parameterization.
But what still worries me is I don't remember exactly how these models, I haven't looked at them in 30 years, but I thought that you had, even within the shape dynamics, if you will, that the curvatures are blowing up.
Yes, that will happen.
And
yeah.
So I'm not sure how you continue the equations through.
This was a big technical problem to do.
Yeah.
So you have a solution for this big technical problem?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Did one of you explain it to MSP?
Yep, yep, sure. So this is, so the upper hemisphere is determined if the triad is greater than, well, det of E, I guess, is bigger than 1. And this is det of E is, sorry, is bigger than 0. Sorry, it's positive. And this is less than 0, it's negative. And so this would be describing the same set of solutions, but left-handed instead of right-handed triads. And as you see at the equator, this is precisely the determinant of the triad becomes 0. So this is the singularity in that sense.
Right.
And let me just say that my goal then is to say what I want to do is just describe a curve on this space. And what I want to ask the question really is that GR will describe this curve. The GR will describe this curve perfectly well everywhere apart from when we get here. That's where the singularity in GR is. This is where you become entirely planar. Beta is pi over 2, tan beta.
And the curvature is blown up.
And the curvature has blown up.
Not just the scale curvature, but the
yes.
curvature.
Yes.
The sheer curvature.
The sheer curvature blows up completely.
Right.
The question is, where does this curve go next? Can we continue this curve? So what I really want to do then is I want an equation of the form alpha dn alpha by d beta n plus da 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 equals 0, something like this, where it's purely in terms of alpha and beta. If I can solve this equation, and if this equation gives me a d alpha by d beta at beta is equal to pi over 2, I'm going to be happy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Also, don't you have more physical interpretation of that singularity in terms of something that's irregular?
Well, I mean, in terms of your shapes, this is what it's done. It's pancaked.
Yeah. But it pancakes with a particular tangent vector. Tangent vector shape, so it can continue.
Can I get to the slide where I do this?
History of pancakes behind it.
It has a very, yeah.
So, I mean, I guess what I'm still seeing, and you tell me you solved it, but I still see a bunch of ODEs that have terms that blow up. And
this ODE, you don't.
Yes.
The ODE written in these equations is entirely Lifshitz continuous.
In terms of
alpha and beta.
Change of variable,
d alpha by d beta. Just to convince you that this is true, so I don't have diagrams by Flavio, but I have equations by Flavio. Now, obviously, I want you all to follow these equations exactly. I was going to say, there's a factor of 2 that he's got wrong here, actually, but, you know. Anyway, these are equations by Mathematica. but the point is, I have alpha and beta, and let's say gamma and omega are related to second and derivatives of alpha and beta and various other things. But the whole point of this is that if you look at alpha dot and beta dot and gamma dot, et cetera, they've all got factors of p in them. Now, p here is the variable that really encodes scale. And so if I actually look at d alpha by d beta, the scale entirely drops out, and I have an alpha of beta and gamma. Likewise, d gamma by d beta, the p drops out, and I have a gamma of beta and da-da-da-da-da. So what I do is I develop an entirely closed system, and just in terms of scale of shape, degrees of freedom.
So you're looking at the rate of change of one of these directions with respect to one of the other directions.
Yes, exactly. Just one with respect to the other. I'm not going to look at, all I want is, as I said a little bit earlier on, I only want an evolution of one scale, one shape parameter with respect to another.
And asymptotically, that all goes to
fleets.
And that's why we were going to match it.
Klaus has just described the next slide. Asymptotically, these things are all going to freeze. So asymptotically, what we're going to find is that we can find the, well, we're all going to find, so we can find. We are going to find that all the first 4 derivatives of alpha with respect to beta are completely finite and well-defined. And if you look back here, this is really an equation, this is really a system in 4 variables. And so it's a fourth order differential equation of alpha and beta. So what I can then do is I can say I can express the entire dynamics on this shape space as just an equation, an ODE of this form, which is Lifshitz continuous.
So doing that is effectively looking at the trajectories, not worrying about the dynamics along the trajectories, isn't it?
We're looking at the trajectories in phase space.
Right.
Yeah. In shape space.
In shape space, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm saying that if you solve this equation of motion, if you solve this dynamical equation, it's very, very hard generically, but fortunately, when you have the fact that these things freeze due to quiescence, this becomes a very, very simple differential equation to solve. Where you can actually solve this in a very small neighborhood around this equator, and you find a completely deterministic alpha of beta about beta is equal to pi over 2.
Does it in any sense go beyond there?
Yes. Yeah. It continues to a point out here, at which point you can hand things entirely back to general relativity.
What you have is configuration space notion
right.
of it's how we normalize the field,
yes.
which is a momentum representation of the same thing. It's the same thing that you get using and that kind of match between values.
Yeah. Yeah. So Glass is describing an approach that really predates us quite considerably and informed quite a lot of the early work on this that at least I was interested in. And that was that you looked at these variables, you looked at the evolution of a dynamical system in terms of the Hubble parameter, because you said the Hubble parameter blows up, all these variables blow up, but maybe some ratio remains finite. And what you then do is you say that these approach an asymptotic set of values. There are in fact two solutions that can approach these asymptotic values from opposite ends, and we can just hook these guys up across this point. What's really new, I think, in the shape interpretation is that if we take these shape variables to be absolutely fundamental to begin with, and we don't just argue that we hook up two solutions here, we actually argue that really something like this is the equation of motion of the universe. And if this is well defined across the singularity, then there is a unique deterministic causal classical solution that continues through the Big Bang.
But it's like I said, this is just the moment, this is a configuration based representation. What we are doing, I
yes. Yeah, absolutely, yes. Yeah, yeah.
So there's a complete dual.
There's a complete dual to this in the momentum space representation. Yeah, I agree.
If I may just come in at that point, did you contemplate going through the singularity? Or am I, from reading of that paper, I think, of 2003, where you introduced the Hubble normalized things, my recollection from that paper was you say that the key variables remain bounded as you approach the singularity, but I don't recall the suggestion that you could go through.
No, we haven't suggested that.
Yeah, but it's absolutely analogous to the Hubble normalization. This is why we were interested, yeah.
The question is this philosophy?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's an interpretation issue. In
it strikes me that if you were, I want to get there. I mean, any kind of physical object that's going, so maybe the solutions are in this picture extending, but
yes.
If you had a physical laboratory, question that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree with you.
Right.
You can't build a physical object to send through this.
Right.
But nonetheless, there is a unique deterministic continuation of the Einstein equations.
Yeah.
So when you speak about the configuration,
yeah.
am I to think of a different definition of time such that when Newtonian time goes to infinity, this other time
so
is finite and I go on?
These singularities happen in finite, what we'd call proper time. But proper time, of course, is a property of general relativity. They happen in a well-defined shape time as well. There are a finite number of oscillations of any shape variable as you approach this. So if you...
What goes to infinity, the singularity?
What would go to infinity...
Proper time is finite.
So tau is finite, but, for example, the Hubble parameter goes up to infinity, or the Ricci scalar goes up to infinity, and various parts of the Ricci tensor will blow up as well.
Also certain ratios between the
shaping
is a
feed-up.
Yeah.
Right, it's not just the scale that's blowing up, it's the sheer.
It's the sheer. The sheer will blow up as well, yeah.
Yeah.
But the physical clock would be built from other, presumably, shaping with a feed-up.
Yeah. Guys, I'm going to suggest, since I don't want to take up more of Klaus's talk. There's going to have a long discussion section right in a little bit, just before lunch or something. So if we can just hold just the continuation just a little bit. So I want to just get through one or two more things before Enrique gets mad at me. Okay. So again, just to say what has happened here, right? Because I realize I've gone through quite a lot. The singularity was not avoided, okay? We have not avoided the GR singularity. I'm no way claiming that Hawking-Penrose is wrong or any nonsense like that. It's absolutely right. These are absolutely GR singular. Geodesics, any object you dropped in here gets crushed. However, the dynamics, as they say, the dynamics is classical at all times, and GR would emerge on both sides. What you could do is, when you have one of these shape solutions, you could impose an idea of scale and solve by quadrature. So somewhere away from this horizon, Julian can say, here's my Brexit 1 foot. And somewhere around here, Sean can say, here's my Canadian meter. And we can impose ideas of scale and evolve entirely with GR on either side of this, and we will completely agree. So the question really is, what happened to the singularity theorems? Well, in a nutshell, the Hawking-Penrose theorems tell you that with a trapped surface and energy conditions, you have incomplete geodesics. That's absolutely true, but as I sort of argued by very, very hand-waving, the fact that two geodesics really seem to converge, well, if all geodesics converge in a certain way, you're actually going to say that there's no rod that you would construct. If you constructed at any time, you could always distinguish these points one from another. As to how you would actually hook up a set of geodesics on one side to the other of this horizon of this equator, I don't know yet. This is something we're trying to work out. It's a little complicated. It's a little difficult. However, what definitely does happen is, what happened to the Friedmann equation? The Friedmann equation is still there. The North Pole still looks like a Friedmann-Robertson-Walker solution. What did happen that's really, really interesting is that the determinant of the triad has flipped sign. So we've flipped orientations as we've gone through this point. If you take Julian's formulation of time, you've also flipped arrows of time about this point, because as you move away from this point, more and more structure can form. Because as the universe expands, you're going to get attractors. As you get attractors, you're going to get clustering. You're going to get structures form. And so if you take this approach, you will find you have histories. And people who live on either side of this, I think you would call it Poincaré recursion, a Janus point, would view time as happening in opposite directions. And so you might also say that operational definition of time has also flipped. So you're really, really in interesting territory here for speculative physics, because you've got CPT symmetries, and we want to know what happens to CPT on either side. Parity has flipped. Time, we think, has flipped. What about charge? Naively, maybe because it's dual to a one form, it should flip, but I'm not entirely sure on this, and this needs to be worked out in proper detail by people who are far better at the standard model than I am.
So do you have any? So you've got rid of, you can evolve through these. The standard singularities of general relativity, are there singularities that occur in the shape dynamics?
We don't know.
Otherwise,
we don't know yet.
Because you write those equations, so whatever variables you've chosen these.
Yeah. So far as I can tell, these seem to remain well defined at all times.
In the type nine.
Yeah. But in general, you're going to have to deal with this becoming a field theory, not a point theory. There are all kinds of things that could go wrong that we have not investigated. The entire goal of my talk here was to get you through this point.
Yeah, but I think the immediate next question is, can you find some place where you can't continue?
100% agree.
So that would be a singularity of a different nature.
I completely agree.
A shape singularity.
I 100% agree. I just don't know how to do this with field theory yet.
Yeah.
One way in which you might say there is sort of interesting or asymptotically singular-ish behavior is that the north and south poles of this system are attractors. And so if you allow a sufficient energy that you're always going to get expansion rather than recollapse, it could be that you just go here and you come back down and you loop or whatever. But if you are asymptoting, for example, the cosmological constant, you end up at the north pole, at which point your shape stops evolving.
Was this with the scalar field or not?
This is with the scalar field, yeah. This is with the mass of the scalar field.
Right, that's what I was going to ask. If you don't have a massive massless scalar field, it would never reach this boundary.
If
right?
you don't have a massless scalar field, what happens is you have an infinitely, you get infinitely close to this infinitely often, arbitrarily close, very, very often, but you can't, I mean, continuing this curve, any arc length parameterization of this curve, you'd have to continue to infinity before you would encounter the horizon, the equator.
Your motion is actually pretty ergodic.
Yeah, it becomes almost ergodic on shape space by the time that would happen. Yeah, on one hemisphere. But the point is that if you built any clock in the system, it would tick an infinite number of times before you got there. Okay, I'm completely out of time, so I think I will quit while I'm not dead. Okay, thank you all.
Cheers. Yeah, time for a few quick questions.
Sean, yeah.
So I think it's a really cool and surprising result.
Yeah.
But one thing that one could say is, like, do we really trust that Einstein gravity is right all the way when things are getting, energy are getting so high? And so even if you do find that the shapes go singular, it's perhaps not a problem, right? I mean, it's very possible that quantum gravity affects quantum shape effects.
Sure.
But we'll kick in it.
Yeah, but there is an issue here which I'd love to discuss with people more, and that is, where is H-bar? Where is the quantum in an intrinsic system? Because H-bar has a scale. H-bar has units. And we say that things act more and more quantum when, you know, things become of order H-bar. And that's when we expect quantum gravity at some ideas, when we get near a Planck length, but of course we don't have lengths. When we get near a Planck curvature, we don't have curvatures. You know, what is going to be the characteristic of quantum gravity in a shape system?
But even if you don't have, like, kind of definite H-bar, maybe you have some kind of emergent H-bar, you still have the one thing you might expect the quantum world to have is commutator relationships between your shapes and your shape momentum. And that will give some kind of Heisenberg uncertainty. Like,
but these things all have units. These units come from somewhere. I mean, commutators have units of H-bar.
No. Well, you don't have to do that. But doesn't one have for these simple cosmological models, which are effectively, so it's quantum mechanics, not quantum field theory.
Yeah.
You can invoke the quantum.
Yeah. I mean, why not just?
You can quantize the system. Like
why not just Wheeler DeWitt quantize this?
You could always study them. Recognize it's only a classical mathematical thing, but in some sense, quantum should take over because nobody knows.
I mean, the natural thing to do here, I think, in some ways, is to follow Tim's thing and follow the Bohmian quantization of these systems. But Klaus has been trying to ask a question for a while, so.
it's true that it's asymptotically frozen, and that's what makes the matching possible. But
yep.
Before it's asymptotic, it's beginning to freeze. So
yes.
So actually, you would have a classical or quantum sandwich in between where the expect changes. But before that, the dynamics is describing what's happening.
Yes.
Classically, and you have to match that with some quantum.
Yep.
You believe that this has any relevance whatsoever eventually to the classical regime.
But the classical
asymptotics is necessary in order to understand what's happening before the asymptotic.
I mean, and out here we are arbitrarily classical. I mean, when we're in this, well, when we're on this shape potential, what Klaus is saying is, when you go off the sort of the last bounds here, things start to freeze, and they freeze well before you get to the point where you stop and you hit the singularity or whatever. Yes, so you have to, so it comes in the strength of the scalar field, and the strength of the scalar field basically tells you the scale, in some sense, at which this freezing that Klaus talks about happens.
I would say it's also just how much energy there is in the scalar field compared with how much there is in the geometry.
Yeah, sure.
It's just a ratio.
But that tells you when this freezing happens. I mean, in the Bianchi models, you think about this as being the intersection of a sphere with a plane. And the more energy you've got in the scalar field, the smaller the sphere is. And at some point, the circle of intersection you get has all positive exponents, and that's the point at which all these evolutions freeze out. And so what really sets this is this ratio of the two energies. Anyway, I'm totally outstaying my welcome here, so.
There was one last question by Vasu. Okay, so, thank you again.